Today is Tuesday, September 8th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the political crisis in Belarus deepens.
Mr. Lukashenko does not have any legitimacy as the president of our country.
Also ahead, Australian journalists flee China amid worsening Beijing-Canberra ties. Plus, a new round of Brexit talks begins. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Belarus, where protest leader Maria Kolesnikova has been found a day after her colleagues said she was kidnapped by masked men. A Belarusian border official told Reuters that Kolesnikova was detained while trying to enter Ukraine in the early hours of Tuesday morning. But Deputy Ukrainian Interior Minister Anton Gerashenko said Kolesnikova, who had been missing for 24 hours, had successfully prevented, quote, a forcible expulsion from her native country, end quote. Reuters' Francis McGuire has the story.
Confusion surrounded the whereabouts of Belarus's protest leader Maria Kolesnikova on Tuesday. Initially, media reports said Kolesnikova and others had successfully crossed into Ukraine, but that was denied by guards on both sides of the border. A Belarusian official later said she was detained while trying to enter Ukraine in the early hours. Ukraine's deputy interior minister, however, said she had successfully stopped an attempt to forcibly remove her from Belarus. Ukrainian media also said she tore up her passport so border officials could not accept her into Ukraine. All that came a day after her allies said she was grabbed off a street in central Minsk by masked men. The circumstances of her attempted journey to Ukraine were not immediately clear. The official Belta news agency said she'd travelled with two other activists who made it into Ukraine. It said Kolesnikova's car had accelerated sharply after being confronted by a border guard. The border service was quoted as saying Kolesnikova had been pushed from the vehicle before it drove towards Ukraine. Reuters could not confirm details of the account. Kolesnikova was one of three female politicians who joined forces to challenge President Alexander Lukashenko in last month's election. She has since played a leading role in mass demonstrations by protesters who accuse him of rigging his re-election. Lukashenko, who has ruled Belarus for 26 years, denies the allegations. He has responded to the protests with a crackdown which saw more than 600 detained over the weekend. Some detainees have accused authorities of torture and beatings.
That was Francis McGuire of Reuters. Kolesnikova is one of the last opposition leaders remaining in Belarus after others have fled President Lukashenko's crackdown. One of those outside Belarus is Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, who is Lukashenko's main political challenger. Under pressure from authorities, she left for Lithuania a day after the contested August 9th election. Today, Tsikhanouskaya described Kolesnikova's ordeal as a kidnapping. Tsikhanouskaya said that future democratic governments in Belarus will not uphold treaties signed by Lukashenko's government.
Countries or parties that make deals with Mr. Lukashenko do so at their own risk. They cannot and should not expect that the Belarusians and their fairly and democratically elected government will uphold the treaties that are made against their will by an illegitimate regime. The commitments and treaties of the Belarusian authorities can be undertaken only in order to benefit the people of the country, not to intimidate them, to oppress them, to torture them.
Tsikhanouskaya was speaking to a committee of the Council of Europe, of which Russia is a member. The Council is the guardian of the European Convention on Human Rights and creator of the European Court of Human Rights in France.
It is well known that the official results of the election of August 9 were falsified. No international organization recognized these false results. The Belarusian people certainly refused to accept this fraud. This means that Mr. Lukashenko does not have any legitimacy as the president of our country.
Lukashenko has denied election improprieties and alleges that foreign powers are trying to topple him. Opposition leader Tsikhanouskaya called for sanctions against Lukashenko's government, the immediate release of what she termed as political prisoners, and the, quote, start of a civilized dialogue to find ways for our country to move forward, end quote. Two Australian media outlets have flown their reporters out of China after what they say was a diplomatic standoff, the latest tense episode as relations between Beijing and Australia continue to deteriorate. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Bill Birtles and Michael Smith, China correspondents for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and the newspaper The Australian Financial Review, were forced to shelter in Australia's embassy in Beijing and its consulate in Shanghai. The journalists were told they were persons of interest in an investigation into a Chinese-born Australian news anchor who's been detained in Beijing. Cheng Li, a high-profile business presenter on Chinese state television, was taken last month into custody, where she remains. According to news reports, Birtles and Smith had been banned from leaving China until they answered questions about Cheng's case. Both men were questioned before being allowed to fly home, where they spoke briefly to reporters at Sydney Airport.
It's very disappointing to have to leave under those circumstances, and it's a relief to be back in a country with genuine rule of law, but this was a whirlwind and it's not a particularly good experience.
It's so good to be home, so happy. I can't say any more at the moment, but such a relief to be home, so really happy.
Did you feel threatened at all when you were over there?
A little bit, yes. It was a complicated experience.
In a statement, the Australian Financial Review said the targeting of two journalists was both regrettable and disturbing and is not in the interests of a cooperative relationship between Australia and China. Diplomatic relations have soured in recent times over allegations of cyber espionage by China and its interference in Australian politics. Beijing has rejected the allegations as nothing but lies. It's imposed tariffs on Australian barley and beef and is conducting an anti-dumping inquiry into Australian wine. Analysts believe that trade is being used to exert pressure on Canberra. Australia has much to lose if relations continue to worsen. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, and its demand for iron ore and coal has underpinned Australia's recent prosperity. The repatriation of the two journalists will add to the mistrust between the countries. Australia's Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, said it was a disappointing series of events. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The extradition hearing of Australian publisher and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in Britain entered its second day today. For more, I spoke to journalist Henry Ridgewell in London.
So the US government alleges that Julian Assange hacked into and published classified documents in the years 2010 and 2011 when he was head of WikiLeaks. Some of those very classified documents, videos, cables, images, and messages that the US government says were not only highly classified, but their publication then put the lives of several operatives in the field at risk, including US service personnel. So the US government has asked Britain to extradite Julian Assange back to the United States, where he would face trial on hacking charges, which could carry a penalty of up to 175 years in jail if he is convicted.
Now, what does the British law say about extradition in this case?
Well, this all comes down really to whether the British judge who is overseeing this hearing and then the British Home Secretary, who has the ultimate decision on this extradition case, whether they believe, first of all, that the crime that the United States government alleges that Julian Assange carried out is also a crime in the UK? So that's the first question that they've got to answer. So if the judge rules that actually the hacking or the activities that took place would not constitute a crime in the United Kingdom, presumably the judge and the Home Secretary would refuse the extradition. That's the main question. There are other considerations as well that have cropped up in past extradition cases about the human rights of the suspect. Would he face a fair trial? The UK does not extradite people to countries where they might face the death penalty after trial. But the United States has given assurances to the British government that Assange would not face the death penalty.
The defense was disappointed by the first day of the trial on Monday. What happened there?
The major development that we saw on Monday as this hearing got underway was the unveiling of a new indictment, which was revealed had actually been issued in June by the US government, which contained 18 further charges against Julian Assange, many of them, you know, similar accusations, plotting to hack computers, conspiring to obtain and disclose national defense information. The defense for Julian Assange tried to argue that those should be thrown out because they had been a last minute addition. That was dismissed by the judge. And then the defense tried to argue for a delay to the hearing so that they could look at these new charges and come up with a defense. That was also dismissed. And their other argument is that they have not seen the defense counsel, have not seen their client, Julian Assange, in 6 months because of the coronavirus pandemic. So they are arguing for further extensions. That's likely to be a major feature of the hearing as well in the coming weeks. The hearing is scheduled to last 4 weeks, but don't be surprised if there are further delays down the line with further appeals, possibly further delays if there is another outbreak of the coronavirus in London and in the UK, and if that delays court hearings further. So still a long way to go in this whole process.
And moving forward in the trial, who will the courts hear from?
They will hear from academics, journalist academics, who will hear about journalistic practices, about whether these are questions of free speech, whether they were in the public interest, because the defense for Julian Assange claims that many of these publications that were made on WikiLeaks revealed abuses and crimes by, U.S. Service personnel or the U.S. armed forces themselves as well. So these are key questions about freedom of the press versus confidentiality and hacking, some of those really deep questions that go to the root of modern society.
That was journalist Henry Ridgewell in London speaking to me earlier today. This is VOA. Tensions increased along the India-China border as both sides accused the other of firing warning shots over their disputed Himalayan boundary. The Indian Army denied its troops were shooting and said the Chinese fired, while the Chinese Foreign Ministry said Indian troops fired in a, quote, serious military provocation, end quote. Both sides have a long-standing agreement to not use firearms along the border, where their troops often stand within meters of each other. The flare-up comes days after the defense ministers of the two countries said they had agreed to work toward diffusing tensions along the contested border. The military standoff began in May after India accused China of intruding across the line of actual control at several points in the high Himalayas. In mid-June, their worst border clash in decades led to the deaths of 20 Indian soldiers. Three candidates to lead Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party launched their one-week campaign to replace Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who is stepping down for health reasons. Yoshihide Suga, the chief cabinet secretary, is considered to be the favorite among party leaders. But rival Shigeru Ishiba, a former defense minister, ranks highly in public opinion polls. The third candidate is ex-foreign minister Fumio Kishida. Party leaders will vote for a new chief on September 14th. Because the center-right LDP dominates the parliament, whoever wins the vote is expected to be named prime minister. The winner will face considerable challenges, including the pandemic, the faltering economy, and the effort to make sure the postponed Tokyo Olympics can proceed. However, analysts have said none of the three candidates is likely to advocate policies that differ much from Abe's. Thank you. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. A fresh round of negotiations between Britain and the European Union begins today over the so-called Brexit. Numerous issues remain unresolved between London and Brussels. For analysis of the situation nearly 4 years after the initial Brexit vote, I spoke to Anand Menon. Menon is a professor of European politics and foreign affairs at King's College, London.
I think one of the interesting things about the Brexit process to date is that the issues in this round of talks are pretty much identical to the issues in the previous round of talks, because the EU has said that certain key issues have to be resolved before the details of a trade deal can be hammered out. And there is fundamental disagreement on principle on some of those key issues, whether it's absurdly, given their economic unimportance, fisheries or state subsidies or minimum standards for workers' rights or the environment. There are fundamental disagreements between the two sides that they just don't seem to be able to get round. And that means that the talks keep returning to the same key issues.
The last few days, there's been a bit of a war of words between UK and EU leaders. There's been accusations, hardening of positions. Does this rhetoric indicate that these two sides are really just very far apart and won't be able to come together?
It depends whether you take the intensification of the rhetoric at face value or not. You could say, well, look, both sides are very frustrated with the other, and there is genuine disappointment, if not anger, at the lack of progress that's been made. And I think there's an element of truth to that. But you could equally say, if you're a student of political drama, that actually Boris Johnson in particular needed a fight during these talks to underline the fact that he was willing to go to the wall to get what he wants. So it could be an element of political theatre, but there is also an element of political substance. And I'd be reluctant to say what proportion of each is at play here, because we probably won't know until the talks finish. But I think there is an element of both.
And so what do you expect to take place as these negotiations move forward?
My sense is that we don't expect to see much at all during this phase of the talks, because ultimately, in order to unlock these negotiations, what is needed is high-level political involvement. And up to date, one of the reasons why progress has been slow is that high-level political involvement has been lacking, for the perfectly understandable reason that political leaders have been obsessed with and preoccupied by COVID. But I think as we approach an EU summit that is scheduled for the 15th of October, those political leaders are going to have to start thinking about Brexit, because it is only via them that the sorts of concessions that both sides are going to need to make are going to be possible.
That was Anand Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College, London. A group of pro-Trump protesters attacked a group of Black Lives Matter protesters in the Flashpoint U.S. state of Oregon on Monday, the Associated Press and local media reported. Police made several arrests. Hundreds of people had gathered for a pro-President Donald Trump vehicle rally. The incident occurred just over a week after a member of a far-right group was shot and killed following a similar vehicle caravan through Oregon's largest city of Portland. Police later shot and killed a suspect in that killing, who was an anti-fascist protester. As the 2020 U.S. presidential race heats up, so do fears of voter suppression and chaotic voting because of the coronavirus pandemic. Heeding stark warnings of problems ahead of the November 3rd election day, some U.S. companies aim to help employees get to the polls. Freddie Joyner of Reuters has more.
As election day in the U.S. draws closer, companies are heeding the stark warnings about potential voter suppression and reduced polling locations, and are being proactive to help facilitate what is expected to be a chaotic 2020 U.S. presidential election. Companies like Twitter and Apple are giving workers paid time off to get to the ballot box, while Starbucks and Old Navy are urging their staff to volunteer at local polling places. Other companies are taking a different approach. Businesses like Nike, Abbott Laboratories, and Qualcomm, along with 800 others, plan to participate in a CEO-led bipartisan activist group called Time to Vote, which encourages companies to give employees at least a few hours off to vote. Starbucks, concerned with Black voter suppression, is urging its over 200,000 U.S. employees register to vote from its mobile app. Starbucks chief executive Kevin Johnson said in an internal memo on August 27th, quote, no employee will have to choose between working their shift or voting on or before Election Day. Rules securing time off for workers to vote vary by state. During these times, mail-in voting has emerged as an alternative for some, but bipartisan battles over expanding mail-in voting have threatened to snarl the political process. President Donald Trump for months has rallied against voting by mail, citing unfounded fraud concerns, and last week encouraged supporters to vote twice, once by mail and again in person, compounding the confusion ahead of Election Day. According to a voter survey by Pew Research, nearly half of voters fear difficulties with voting in the U.S. presidential elections.
Thanks to Freddie Joyner of Reuters for that report. There have been more than 27.2 million total COVID-19 cases worldwide and over 890,000 deaths. But World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warns Monday that as countries fight the new coronavirus, they must also prepare for future disease outbreaks.
This will not be the last pandemic. History teaches us that outbreaks and pandemics are a fact of life. But when the next pandemic comes, the world must be ready, more ready than it was this time. In recent years, many countries have made enormous advances in medicine, but too many have neglected their basic public health systems, which are the foundation for responding to infectious disease outbreaks.
The United States has the most COVID-19 cases, with over 6.2 million, including more than 188,000 deaths. WHO figures say India is next, with over 4.2 million reported cases and nearly 73,000 deaths, followed by Brazil, which has recorded over 4.1 million cases and more than 126,000 deaths. China, where the disease originated, says it has managed to suppress the virus within its borders, with over 90,000 reported cases and nearly 5,000 deaths. But Mike Ryan, director of WHO's emergencies program, warns that China must remain vigilant.
There's always the risk that disease can flare up again and sporadic cases can turn into clusters. Clusters can turn into community transmission, and community transmission can lead to overwhelmed health systems.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the Declaration of Independence, America's founders defined unalienable rights as including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These rights are considered inherent in all persons and roughly what we mean today when we say human rights, said Peter Berkowitz, director of the State Department Policy Planning Staff. These rights don't just protect Americans at home, but form the basis for a moral foreign policy abroad, said Mr. Berkowitz.
We took on obligations to champion them in 1948. Presidents from both political parties have championed human rights, and America's founding commitments involve respect for the dignity that inheres in all human beings.
A year ago, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo convened the Commission on Unalienable Rights with a specific mandate, said Director Berkowitz.
Secretary Pompeo asked members of the commission to investigate, to reground America's undoubted commitment to human rights and foreign policy in America's founding documents, in the Declaration of Independence, Constitution of the United States, in the American constitutional tradition, and also to help us understand America's undoubted commitment to human rights in light of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we signed on to in 1948.
Unalienable rights directly affect U.S. relations with individual countries, said Director Berkowitz.
We see it, for example, in Secretary Pompeo's repeated condemnations of the imprisonment of Muslim Uyghurs in Chinese internment camps. We saw it in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan championed the human rights of the dissidents that the Soviet Union had cruelly imprisoned in their gulags. We hear it when the administration takes on the Islamic Republic of Iran, which also represses its own citizens.
While human rights are certainly not the totality of American foreign policy, noted Director Berkowitz, they are one essential component, one key part of the mix of American foreign policy.
That was an editorial reflecting